At Still Austin Whiskey Co., we make award-winning whiskey 100% in-house, from grain all the way to glass. We only use Texas-grown grains distilled in the heart of Austin, where the wild weather helps age our whiskey to perfection. Go to stillaustin.com for delivery right to your door today. Still Austin Whiskey, the art of Texas whiskey.
Texas Monthly.
Hey there, I'm John Spong with Texas Monthly Magazine, and this is One by Willie, a podcast in which I talk each week to one notable Willie Nelson fan about one Willie song that they really love. This week, we talk with Willie's longtime harmonica player, Mickey Raphael, a musician whose playing is as vital to Willie's sound as Trigger in Willie's own voice. He's here to discuss a fairly forgotten cut from Willie's last days in Nashville, The Words Don't Fit the Picture, which is a song that predates Mickey even meeting Willie, but it's also the song that made him first hope there was a place for him in Willie's band. From there, he touches on the truly freaky photo of Willie that's on that album's cover. Man, talk about words not fitting pictures. Check that one out. Before giving an eyewitness look at life inside Willie World, describing things like the unlikely way he was invited to join the family, concerts in which the band decided to just keep playing till dawn, stowaways on Willie's bus, and so on. Oh, and he also talks about how much his 50-year friendship with Willie means to him. Let's do it.
These are.
If this is a game we play, and if this is a role I play.
What's so cool about the song The Words Don't Fit the Picture?
Well, you know, I've got to say that just first off, the first thing that caught me was the harmonica. Mm-hmm. Charlie McCoy is playing harmonica on it. And the harp part is just so, it's not overplayed. Charlie's one of these guys that doesn't play any notes that don't absolutely have to be there.
Okay.
And he's actually playing notes that don't exist on the harmonica. He's bending notes, which is a technique that you do on the harmonica, to get notes that don't really exist. But it's just such a simple kind of a haunting sound that he gets. And that's what first piqued my interest on this tune. It's like, oh, this incredible harmonica part. So maybe, you know, what registered was, maybe there's a part for me in Willie World. But then listening to the song, I mean, just musically, it's different. I mean, it has such jazz voicings, and the changes are just not your typical country song. And it deals with a basic storyline. The words don't fit the picture. I mean, you say something, and it's not really what's happening in real time, and it just hits me on so many levels. But the first thing that caught my ear was the harmonica, and it just drew me in.
Well, and if folks don't know who Charlie McCoy is, he was one of the Nashville A-Team session players, one of the first call guys whenever any Chet or Owen Bradley, Chet Atkins, who produced Willie's stuff back then, and Felton Jarvis, who produced this, I think, because this was 1971. Charlie McCoy was the harmonica player you'd bring in. And if I remember, the story is that he came to Nashville, he wanted to make it maybe playing guitar and as a singer, songwriter, whatever. And he realized, oh, well, there's a lot of those here, and that's not going to work. So he decided, yeah, but there's not a lot of harmonica players. If I can just play the harmonica well, I'll always have a place when they call people to come record.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there's no harmonica players other than Charlie. and he set the bar. You know, there's never been anyone to play like him or to make, you know, an impact on music. And saying so much with so little notes, you know, which is really, it's hard for a harmonica player because first off, you don't have anything to hide behind. You're pretty naked up there with this little piece of tin in your mouth. and most players, me included, tend to play way too much. So I think with age or with experience, you kind of back off. And Charlie's just one of those guys that has definitely achieved saying a lot with, you know, with a minimal amount of notes.
And if we've been acting all along, and we both act right, and we both act wrong, where does it say that we should cry?
Well, yeah, that's what lyrics. It's like he's been reading my mail.
Well, and it's interesting. So at that period in the early 70s, he's going through a breakup with his second wife, Shirley, who presumably that's written about, or, you know, it's during that. And it's funny because it's one of those Willie things where he's, in a sense, letting her know that everything's going to be okay. He is leaving her, you know.
Yes.
And he's already with Connie.
Right. It's going to be, everything's going to be okay for him.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. There's kind of that element. But then the other thing is, you know, the album before this is Yesterday's Wine, which is one of my very favorite records I've ever heard by anybody. It was so weird. You know, it didn't do anything, you know. And then this album, because this was the title cut to the album, Words Don't Fit the Picture, it comes out in 72, and it doesn't even chart. The single, this song was released as a single, and it was on the charts for 2 weeks. I think it got to 73 or something. It's not quite working, and that's after years of frustration at RCA, who he knows is fixing to drop him, you know, to let him go.
Right.
So in a very real sense, he's going through two nasty divorces in this moment that he's singing about here. There's a lot in there.
Yeah, a lot of information to write about, a lot of inspiration. Yeah, it was a hard time for him. Emotionally, and you know, these are this is what came out of it. You know, this is something good that came out of those you know, those hard times.
Well, and I cut you off a little while ago when you started to talk about how nuts that album cover is. But yeah, it's very difficult times for Willie. But I mean, and anybody listening to this, we should really just hit pause and Google the album cover art, because I mean.
Yeah, Willie's standing in front of the rolls with Connie. I can't remember if she's wearing fur. She might be wearing a fur hat. And then Felton Jarvis, the producer, is the chauffeur.
It's his big rolls.
Yeah, Willie's wearing bell bottoms, which he did anyway, I think, in those times.
Yeah.
But that's actually a great picture of Willie. So, and Connie looks fabulous.
The suggestion that in the middle of all of this difficulty, especially with RCA, he might be a rock star with a Rolls and a chauffeur. That's a nice inside joke between Willie and Chet and maybe a handful of others, I guess.
Yeah. His covers back there were fabulous. The one, it's called Willie and Family. One of those, my favorite songs on that is I'm a Memory. We have to go back and talk about that cover, too, eventually. That's one where everybody is, the whole family's around the bonfire.
In Willie's place in Ridgetop, right?
Yeah, and I asked him one time, I mean, I see Paul, Willie B., who is wearing like a fuzzy pair of, it looks like boxer shorts. And they're out, it's obviously winter, they're around a bonfire. And I said, who is this? And they go, well, this is, you know, the whole family. Bobby's there with her husband, I think, and kids, and they're really young. And Lana, Willie's daughter, was there with her babies. And then there's one guy I didn't recognize. I said, well, who is this one guy? Who is this guy? And they go, oh, we don't know. He just walked up out of the woods and was standing by the fire, which kind of sums up everything. You know, I mean, we'll be doing a recording session with Willie, and there'll be a couple of people or one guy in the studio. It's like, Is this guy with you? No, I thought he was with you. You know, somebody just walked in, or, you know, that's kind of been our MO through the, you know, in the early years. I mean, there was a guy, we were on tour, and there was a guy riding on our bus for several days. And we were up in the East, and I said, B, you know, who's your friend? He goes, my friend? I thought that was your friend. And this guy had just been traveling with us, and find out that nobody knew who he was. He'd just gotten on the bus. So it didn't surprise me at all when they said, oh, that guy just walked out of the woods.
And it's weird, too, because that record, like when people bellyache, when Willie fans talk about how Nashville mistreated Willie. I mean, I love so many of those records from the 60s, and to me, they just sound, they don't sound like you guys later, but it sounds like great 60s era country music.
It's my favorite. It's my personal favorite.
Really?
Those, yeah. And Then I Rode, Willie and Family.
You know,
Words Don't Fit the Picture, Lay My Burdens Down, all the RCA stuff back then. It's just brilliant.
When so on back to the Words Don't Fit the Picture specifically, you talked about it having jazz chords in it. I'm not going to be able to identify that. But
nor me, but it sounds very intellectual.
Yeah, sure enough.
but no, that wasn't your basic, you know, three-chord country song. You know,
right.
Even though it was pretty simple, it wasn't too complicated a song to play. It just was, you know, it's kind of timeless. It just didn't fit, you know, definitely didn't fit with what was going on, you know, in Nashville at that time.
Well, when I get to overthinking it, one thing that did strike me as cool about it, at the verses, at least the first one or two, it sounds almost like it doesn't resolve itself at the end, you know? And so when he sings, "Where are the words I say to you? The words don't fit the picture anymore." It kind of ends without resolution. And it's almost like the end of the verse is a cliffhanger. And then he goes into, "If we've been acting all along, we both act right, we both act wrong." You know, he leaves it there again. But then at the very end, he does kind of, you keep thinking, oh, wait, it's a cliffhanger. Maybe this is going to work out. What's going to happen next? And then he says, "Nope, it's a one-act play that comes to an end." And it's like, oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, he keeps pushing you towards the edge, and you don't actually go over till the end. You know, you figure it out till the end. So it's, Willie's really brilliant.
It's awfully sophisticated.
Yeah, in a very simple way, too, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
It's just the words don't fit the picture anymore.
Well, so... had you listened to a bunch of, you grew up in Dallas, right?
I grew up in Dallas, but I had no country background whatsoever. I think the only country song I was exposed to was as a, you know, a teen was Blood on the Saddle, Tex Ritter. And, you know, I thought, oh, this is country music. I'm you know, I'll pass. but, you know, I grew up in Dallas and I was kind of into the 60s folk scene.
Okay.
And the English, you know, the British invasion, you know, I love, you know, the Stones and the Animals. And, you know, I had no country background. And then when I met Willie, you know, he was so neat. He didn't strike me as your typical country and Western singer. And I was just so enamored by his guitar playing and his writing. You know, I just really kind of, you know, latched on to his music and started doing a crash course in his music and found those RCA records. Well, at the time I was playing with B.W. Stevenson, mm-hmm. who had some local success in Dallas, and we were on RCA, and we'd go down to the when we would go to the RCA offices, they had a vault with you know, all the records that they were releasing. B.W., the Guess Who, you know, I can't remember who else was on RCA at the time, and there was this Willie record, and that's the record the first record I picked was the Willie and Family. What was the one with everybody standing around the fire pit at Willie's ranch or Willie's farm in Ridgetop. And I thought, and I just picked it because it was such a weird album cover. And I thought, wow, this is crazy. Who is this guy? But, you know, that was my first introduction to Willie was the and Family record, and it was the album cover that drew me in, you know. And then I end up meeting Willie in 72 through Coach Royal, and you know, kind of put it all together, and it just really you know, I got interested in was definitely interested in Willie, but then got interested in the rest of the you know, the world of country music.
Tell me about that first meeting, because it's kind of legendary, and I don't want to blow too much smoke, but in fact, I mean, I really think that you meeting Willie, and when you think of how important he is as an artist, as a figure in American history, and how important your harmonica is to his sound, I don't think it's that, for me personally, that's on par with Lennon running into McCartney.
you know, in high school or whatever they called it in Liverpool, or Jagger meeting Richards. And I know that's a pretty dramatic thing to say, but you and Willie hooking up really changed history.
Yeah, well, it changed my life anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and thanks to Daryl Royal and Edith Royal, you know, who, I mean, Daryl was a real patron of the arts and a close friend of Willie's and a serious music fan. And I guess they'd heard me play with BW or heard me playing around Austin. And I guess they knew I was in Dallas, and the coach was at a ball game. I think Texas was playing Arkansas that weekend. And he got word to me and said, you know, hey, we're having a little picking session in my hotel after the ball game. Why don't you grab your harmonicas and come over, and I'd like to meet you, and you can meet some of my friends.
Oh, wow.
So, and I wasn't a big football fan at all. I mean, I wasn't, because I knew who Coach Royal was, but I was not an athlete. And the reason I was a musician was because I couldn't play sports, you know. So I go over there, and Willie's there. Charlie Pride was there. I had met him because my dad designed and built custom furniture, and Charlie was one of his clients. So I had met Charlie when, you know, I was a teenager. And I was 20 at this time. And they just passed the guitar around, and I had my harmonicas, and I just tried to play along with them. Willie did Nightlife and Funny How Time Slips Away and Crazy. And I thought, oh, this is the guy that wrote those songs. And
wow.
After that little party, Willie says, hey, if you ever hear we're playing anywhere, come sit in. And a couple of months go by, and I read that Willie is playing in a high school gym or junior high gymnasium, a benefit for a volunteer fire department in Waxahachie. So I drive down there, show up, and sit in with him, you know, and play with the band. And they're set up on the floor, you know, on the court in the gym. And I think we played Fraulein 4 or 5 times that night because people like to dance. They like to two-step, you know. So it gave me a chance to learn the song. They weren't hard songs, but I really didn't know any of these songs. And he was just playing standards. And afterwards, we went to the truck stop, right, you know, on 35 and had breakfast, which is what you do at 1 in the morning. And, you know, I was getting ready to leave, and I thought, well, I'll have one more cup of coffee. And that last cup of coffee, Willie says, hey, we're going to New York in a couple of months to play Max's Kansas City. Why don't you go with us? So the rest is my history anyway, you know. So that was a couple of months previous to the Max's gig. And then I'd just look and find, I think I would call Connie or something and say, you know, is Willie there? Nah, I haven't seen him in several days. Or I would find out where they were. They'd be playing around Texas, and I'd just drive my car down there and show up and play. So that's kind of how I learned. You know, I learned this. We didn't practice, but that's how I, learned, you know, to play with him, by showing up, you know, 4 or 5 times on the weekends. He would just be playing weekends. And then one day, Willie asked Paul English, our drummer and band leader, he says, what are we paying Mickey? And Paul goes, nothing. He's just coming to sit in. And Willie, famous line is, Willie says, you know, we'll double his salary.
Well, but then one of the things that was so different about the band after you joined, or at least different from pretty much every country band that there had been prior to that, is that there's no steel guitar and there's no fiddle. You know, and in fact, your harmonica replaces the steel guitar with a lot of what it does, right?
Yeah. I had Jimmy Day playing, who is an iconic pedal steel player. And when Jimmy left the band, Willie wasn't going to replace him with another steel player.
Right.
So I happened to be playing. I had just started playing. And so I just kind of, segued from, the steel as a voice in the band to the harmonica, because he wasn't going to hire, like I say, another player, because you couldn't replace, you know, Jimmy Day.
Right.
So, the timing was, was perfect.
Well, when I talked to Steve Earle, it was an offhand comment. He was making a joke, kind of, but he said, in talking about the way the band sounded and how unique and different it was from country bands that preceded it, he said that, you know, there were two great achievements of the Armadillo World Headquarters, and one is the one everybody thinks of, which is the hippies and the rednecks communing. But the other was, he said that those hippies being there and the Grateful Dead being there and bands like that gave Willie permission to form a jam band as opposed to a traditional country band. And that was an interesting way to think about it, because it really does sound very different from Ray Price's band 10 years ago, or the way Ernest Tubb and those guys, you know, in his players.
Yeah, we're not as structured as that. Well, I don't think we're as accomplished musicians as those guys, really. But I mean, we are a great jam band. At that time, we were playing four-hour sets.
What?
We would just play, you know, and songs would last forever. And they were just, I mean, whatever we were fueled on at the time was working. But it was... you know, I remember we played an outdoor festival in Baton Rouge, and it was raining, and it, you know, looked like the Walking Dead out in the audience. And Willie thought, let's see if we can outlast this audience. And we played till the sun came up. And it looked like a zombie apocalypse.
Well, and when you talk about it being loose, who keeps time? Who do you follow in the
band? I've been asking myself that question for 48 years. We all keep time, and I think we're all on listening to a different drummer. It doesn't matter. It's like Willie starts the song, and as long as we end close together and nobody gets hurt, it's fine.
Whiskey River, take my mind. Don't let a memory torture me. Whiskey River, don't run dry. You're all I got to care for me.
Well, and then the other guys in the band, the other people in the band, what are, just in a nutshell, what are they like, and what do they bring? Like, every time B. Spear's name comes up, whoever brings it up starts laughing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, besides being a great bass player with Willie, he was a real joker. And sometimes the jokes were at great expense, but as long as he could get a laugh. You know, we were in Vegas, and there's a YouTube video of this. We were in Vegas hanging out we'd play these two-week runs at Caesar's Palace. And we're hanging in the bar after one of the shows, and he meets these guys that are the riggers for Peter Pan. You know, they fly her. They do all the rigging. And they were between shows. So B says, could you fly me? And they go, well, yeah, we've got the harness and everything. So B talked him into coming to a show, and it was Saturday night at Caesar's Palace, sold out show. And they hook B up in this harness that's connected at the hips with these eye hooks. And it's kind of an old style that they were doing. And you had to fly, they hoist you up, and then you have to arch your back and get your body in a particular position where you're balanced. So when you're moving, you're horizontal. Well, B could never get that position right. So Saturday night, B walks off stage. We had another bass player. We had Chris Etheridge with us. So Willie's doing Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground. B slides off stage, gets in the harness. They hoist him over our heads, and they're pulling him back and forth across the stage. But B is doing somersaults because he can't keep his body in the right position to be horizontal. And the crowd is going nuts during Willie's solo. And, of course, Willie's nodding, thank you very much, thank you very much. You know, he has no idea at this point that B is upside down, you know, hovering 10 feet over our heads.
That sounds like the person I've heard described.
Yeah, I remember he wanted to have he was having a cookout at his house one time. And, you know, to his wife's dismay, he took the box spring. I think Leon was out there too, and he was going to cook a goat. So he dug a big pit, took the box, ripped the box spring up off of his bed, and put the box spring over the pit, and built a fire under it, and then laid the goat on the on the box spring because he didn't have a grill big enough.
Oh, wow. I mean, that actually certainly sounds like everybody I know from Bandera.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where it was.
Was Paul English intimidating the first time you met him? What was Paul like?
Yeah, Paul was pretty intimidating, even though he was just a sweetheart and a pussycat and really kind of the enforcer. I mean, we were playing places that I couldn't really go in by myself, these redneck joints. This Big G's was one in Round Rock, Texas. And I had really long hair. And this was, you know, right at the end of the Vietnam War. And, you know, it was the air was politically charged. And I would wait in my car, and Paul would get there, and I'd walk in with with he and the rest of the guys, and anybody who'd say anything. I mean, Paul was pretty serious character, and always packing, always had a pistol or several guns on him, and rightfully so, because a lot of times he had to collect money. A promoter didn't want to pay us, and Paul would go in there and convince the guy that it was in his. The best interest of his health to pay us,
and then Jody, I've he's the one guy that I've never really heard much about.
Yeah, Jody was married to Sammy Smith, who had the big hit "Help Me Make It Through the Night."
Yeah,
and then he was playing with he played with Merle. He toured with Merle's band, and he's from Kentucky, and he has a great bluegrass background. I think he was playing in bands when he was probably 12 years old. But he, he brought, played lead guitar and sang harmony with Willie.
And so it's varying degrees of musicianship, but everybody getting along and bonding and working this thing together.
Yeah, because it wasn't a democracy. I mean, it was a band, but it was we had a boss. And that was Willie. And, it's like anything goes, but you just want to be, there were no rules other than show up for the gig and be able to play.
And if you're doing that 200 nights a year for 40 years, I guess eventually there is some telepathy involved.
Oh, yeah. Total communication without speaking,
We talked about, or one thing I was curious about that I asked ahead of time about was the way you and Willie's playing interacts, and the other song you've been talking about through this has been "I'm a Memory," which is on Willie and Family, but then it's also on the live album that came out 7 years later, Willie Nelson and Family Live, that was recorded at Harrah's Casino, Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
Okay, let me play that real quick because I want to hear the two of you guys together.
Man, that must have taken a lot of coffee.
Thank you.
Coffee, you say? Well, that's one of the famous things that I first heard it from you when I interviewed you a long time ago. There was Willie's famous edict about being what happens when you're wired.
Oh, if you're wired, you're fired?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, at the time we were starting to make a little money, and, drugs were around, and if we, cocaine was there. I knew some people that did it, and that was what Willie didn't care if we were if we drank or smoked, but he said, "I don't want to see my guys, spending good money on bad drugs," And cocaine was not a very creative drug at all, especially musically. It just made you play really fast.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because at that time, when cocaine first starts showing up in the 70s, people thought it's not addictive. It's expensive, but it's really not that bad. But weed was still looked at as this terrible thing. It seemed like it was probably the effect that it had on musicians that was one of the things that helped people realize, oh, yeah, cocaine's actually bad.
Yeah, it's just a bad drug to listen on, where marijuana will kind of mellow you out, and relax you, and you can really groove and listen to music. When you're high on coke, you're talking all the time and you're not listening to the other person. And one thing about playing music is you've got to listen to the other players. And, you can hear some records. I'm not sure who in our band was using, but when everybody's playing on top of each other, I mean, there's something there that's not, that you wouldn't normally be doing. It's just like, talking a lot without listening.
Huh. Well, it's an interesting song to summon cocaine talk, because I don't think this is necessarily what happened, but Joe Nick Petoskey once, who wrote the biography on Willie, the big one, once told me, he said that this song, "I'm a Memory," he feels confident is Willie's first ever public championing of marijuana. And I said, "What?" And he said, "No, listen to the lyrics. It's a good riddance song. It's a, you're gonna miss me type song." And he's mentioning moments in this lover's life when after he's gone, she's going to be missing him. And he says, I'm a love that you bought for a song. I'm a voice on a green telephone. Joe Nick said, that's weed, man.
No, 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 no. They had green telephones. I mean, yeah. there was, yeah.
Yeah.
I never thought about that, though. Wow.
Thank you. I needed that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and I'm going to have to call Willie up and say, hey, can I have a bag of green telephone, please? That's what they ought to name some of that stuff.
Absolutely. He's going to connect you to somebody.
Green telephone. That's right.
I'm a love that you bought for a song. And I'm a voice on a green telephone. And I'm a day that lasted so long.
And when you are playing with him, like when we listened to I'm a Memory just now, what is your harmonica supposed to do in relation to his guitar? Or do y'all just do your thing? Is there...
We never discussed it, but I know the original one, and I know what there was strings on it. There's kind of a string part, and mm-hmm. I know, and I so I also echoed the signature line that B, you know, that the bass player was doing, and I know kind of what licks Willie's going to play on it, because there's a certain signature, melody there or lick there that Willie's going to do. And sometimes I would double it, you know, or answer him. So it's, again, it's a conversation, and Willie may play something and I may answer, you know? So in fact, in the great words of Leon Russell's percussionist, this wonderful African medicine man named Ambrose Campbell. He said, he told me one time, he goes, music is but a language. Speak to me and I will answer.
Okay. Wow. It's not relevant at all, but my kids are named Willie and Leon.
No.
It just made sense. It just made sense. But the friendship with Willie, what's it akin to? Are y'all... like brothers? Is it akin to father-son thing or uncle-nephew or?
All of that. It's brothers. It's you know, he can be a father figure at times. So, you know, he maintained several roles there. But it's always, I always lean to him, lean on him for inspiration. And, and again, sometimes it's not discussed, but I'll listen to how he approaches something. Musically, and I know what to do because just kind of seeing how he approaches a problem or approaches the music.
Can you think of an example? Has there been a moment where like you needed counsel or were putting a Willie record on was what you needed, or are you tired of hearing all that?
Well, I've told him, if I was going through a crisis or in a relationship, I said, man, this song or this record, has really consoled me. You know, I always told Willie that I would go to his songs, to his lyrics, before I would go to my shrink, you know? I mean, really, especially this era, the late 60s, early 70s. But it really was. There's something just very therapeutic about, seeing somebody else going through something that you may have experienced. And that's what's great about Willie.
And a one-act play comes to an end.
It has such great appeal because he speaks to people's everyday experiences. And everybody can identify with what he's saying.
But this is the time to say goodbye. Goodbye. 'Cause the words don't fit the picture anymore.
All right, Willie fans, that was the great Mickey Raphael telling us about the words don't fit the picture. A huge thanks to him for coming on the show, and a big thanks to you for tuning in. If you dig the show, please subscribe, maybe tell a couple friends, and visit our page at Apple Podcasts and give us some stars. And please also check out our One by Willie playlist over at Apple Music. Be sure to tune back in next week to hear singer-songwriter Nathaniel Ratliff talk about biker funerals,
Leon Russell and the Leon Russell song that closes out Willie's album Shotgun Willie, A Song for You. One by Willie is a production of Texas Monthly Magazine. The show is produced and engineered by Brian Standifer and Patrick Michaels, produced by Megan Kreit, with art design from Emily Kimbrough and Victoria Milner, and I'm your host, John Spong. We will see y'all next week.
At Still Austin Whiskey Co., we make award-winning whiskey 100% in-house, from grain all the way to glass. We only use Texas-grown grains distilled in the heart of Austin, where the wild weather helps age our whiskey to perfection. Go to stillaustin.com for delivery right to your door today. Still Austin Whiskey, the art of Texas whiskey.